In 2017, the country of New Zealand did something that, honestly, completely breaks the Western legal brain.
Oh, absolutely, it does.
Right. Like they looked at the Whanganui River, which is this massive, winding, living body of water, and they legally granted it the exact same rights as a human being.
Yeah, not just as some, poetic gesture either.
Exactly. Not a symbol, as a literal legal entity, a river that can technically sue, and incredibly, a river that actually has legal liabilities.
Which is just wild to think about.
It's totally mind-bending. And so today on the Deep Dive, we are looking at the invisible plumbing of civilization. We are tearing into this fascinating brand new framework that asks a pretty brutal, non-romantic question.
Right.
Do institutions that actually put human life before profit exist anywhere in the messy, complicated real world?
And I mean, the reason we really have to ask that question so bluntly is because we are completely surrounded by systems that do the exact
Yeah,
opposite.
constantly.
We live in a reality where the baseline requirements for like biological and mental survival are just routinely treated as commodities.
So true.
So we are diving into a deeply empirical paper today by Dr. Bechara Sehely. It is the fourth paper in what is known as the Life Coherent Peace
Okay,
Sequence.
the fourth paper.
Yeah. And the first three papers built this massive theoretical foundation. They defined peace not simply as, the absence of weapons firing, but as the organized enablement of life.
Wow, the organized enablement of life. I like that.
Right. But this fourth paper, which is titled Civil Commons in Practice, it basically abandons pure theory.
It gets into the weeds.
Exactly. It looks at the dirt, the mud, the pipes, and the budgets of six very real, very flawed human systems to see if we can extract a transferable grammar for survival.
Okay, so let's unpack this concept that sits right at the center of the entire paper, which is the civil commons.
Let's do it.
Because I know for you listening, the moment you hear a phrase like civil commons or, public institution, your brain probably instantly generates an image of a soul-crushing, fluorescent-lit DMV waiting room.
Oh, yeah, holding the little paper ticket.
Right. You're holding a tiny paper ticket with a number on it for 3 hours.
Oh.
We just tend to associate these words with cold bureaucracy.
And that's a very fair association based on our experiences.
But Dr. Salhili is arguing something entirely different here. Like, if you think of human society as a house, the civil commons isn't the drywall. It isn't the paint.
No.
It's the plumbing. It's the electrical wiring, the concrete foundation. It is the shared baseline life support system that does not force you to swipe a credit card before it decides to work.
Yeah, it is the absolute definition of invisible life support. And you only notice it the second it fails.
Right, when the pipe bursts.
Exactly. And the paper is incredibly strict about what actually qualifies as a civil commons because just because a government owns something, that does not make it a civil commons.
Oh, definitely not.
I mean, a public agency can technically deliver a service while completely humiliating the people it serves.
Yeah, making you jump through a million hoops.
Right. It can be coercive, it can be deeply exclusionary, and it can exist purely to protect its own administrators.
To justify its own budget.
Exactly. So to cut through the romanticization of public goods, Dr. Sahili uses this ruthless 10-question analytical framework to evaluate six global case studies.
And the framework asks, what life good is actually at stake here? What financial or bureaucratic pressures are actively threatening it? And what specific mechanism was built to protect it?
Right.
It looks at how human capacities are enabled, what forms of violence are reduced, and how we actually measure success without just, looking at a profit margin.
Which is key.
But to me, the most important question in the framework is about repair. Like, what happens when the system inevitably screws up?
Yes, it will.
Because none of the cases we're looking at today are utopias.
No, they are far from utopias. They are battleground.
Yeah.
The paper analyzes systems governing water, health, education, ecology, governance, and finally, that wild integrative case you mentioned regarding the river.
The New Zealand River, yeah.
Right. And the goal is not to find a perfect system and mindlessly copy it.
Because you can't just copy-paste a society.
Exactly. The goal is to isolate the underlying grammar, the transferable rules of how a society actually secures life, expands human capability, and crucially, detects its own failures.
So we have to start with the absolute baseline. If you don't get this first system right, the entire house just collapses.
Yeah.
We are starting with water. Because without safe drinking water, every other human capacity, thought, education, political participation, it all becomes mathematically impossible.
Your body just shuts down.
The cells in your body literally stop functioning.
Water is the non-negotiable condition for biological viability. So, in Dr. Sahili's framework, The life good at stake here is defined as water is life.
Water is life.
Yeah, and this isn't just about H2O molecules in a glass. It is about safe, affordable, reliable, and ecologically sustained drinking water as a fundamental condition for hygiene, for food preparation, human dignity, and social participation.
Because if you are spending 5 hours a day walking to a contaminated well, you are structurally excluded from participating in any other aspect of civilization.
Absolutely. You can't go to school, you can't vote, you can't work.
So the paper zeroes in on Paris, France.
Yeah.
And the story here is this massive institutional whiplash.
Yeah, it's quite a story.
For a quarter of a century, from 1985 all the way to 2009, the city of Paris essentially rented out its water management to private corporate entities.
Right. They just outsourced the whole thing.
But then there was this massive public reckoning. On January 1st, 2010, the city executed a total reversal.
A complete 180.
They pulled the entire system back into public hands and created Eau de Paris, which is a 100% public company designed to take over the entire chain.
The whole thing.
Production, transport, distribution, monitoring, they grabbed all of it.
And to understand why they did that, we have to look at the threat identified in the paper, which is the money sequence pressure.
Right.
When a society decides to treat its baseline water supply primarily as a revenue stream, the entire logic of the system warps.
It totally changes.
Right, because if the ultimate goal is generating a return for shareholders, then maintaining the underground pipes is no longer viewed as a life protection duty.
It's just a cost.
It is viewed as an annoying expense that eats into profits. So infrastructure investment gets continually deferred.
Right, because replacing 100 miles of century-old iron piping doesn't look good on the quarterly earnings report.
Exactly.
So you wait until the pipe literally bursts, floods a street, and causes a crisis before you spend the money.
You wait for the disaster.
And meanwhile, the cost to the everyday person just keeps creeping up.
And when those costs become unbearable for low-income residents, a privatized money sequence system frames that lack of affordability simply as a customer problem.
A customer problem. Wow.
Yeah, it is entirely individualized. The system basically says, well, we provided the product, you failed to purchase it.
That's so cold.
It is. It completely ignores the fact that depriving someone of water is an act of severe structural violence.
Okay, but I have to throw a massive red flag on the play right here, though.
Go for it.
The city of Paris kicks out the private corporations, they put a public logo on the water bill, and what? The water magically gets pure.
Right.
We both know that public utilities can be absolute nightmares.
No, for sure. Think of Flint, Michigan.
Exactly. They can be disastrously underfunded by politicians who just want to cut taxes.
Yeah.
They can be deeply politicized, completely opaque to the public, and frankly, just terrible at actually delivering safe water.
Yeah.
Just changing the name on the building from Corporate Inc. to Department of Water does not guarantee a civil commons.
And the paper explicitly validates that skepticism. Remunicipalization, just making it public, does not automatically cure a system.
Okay.
Because a public bureaucracy can be just as life-blind as a private corporation. What elevates the Eau de Paris case into a genuine civil commons mechanism is the depth of its integration.
What do you mean by integration here?
Well, they didn't just take over the billing department and the municipal pipes under the streets. They integrated the entire cycle, stretching all the way back to the ecological source.
Oh, they went after the watershed.
They did. They recognized that you cannot protect the tap if you do not protect the land that filters the water before it ever reaches the city.
That makes total sense.
Yeah. They framed water explicitly as a precious common good for present and future generations. It became a mission-oriented enterprise focused on reinvestment, not extraction.
The paper talks a lot about this concept of felt being and relational legitimacy in this context.
Yeah, those are big terms.
Right. And at first glance, they sound like incredibly dense academic terms. But think about what it actually feels like to interact with the institutions that keep you alive.
It's very visceral.
Relational legitimacy means how the institution views you.
Yeah.
Are you treated as a citizen? An active participant who has a fundamental right to a shared life support system?
Right.
Or are you just an account number, a consumer who will be cut off the second your bank account dips too low?
Which is terrifying.
That subtle shift in how the institution views you completely changes your psychological reality, which the paper calls your felt being. It removes that constant ambient terror of losing your access to survival.
And that shift dictates what the institution actually chooses to measure. A lifeblind system measures profit margins and market share.
Right.
But Eau de Paris, as a civil commons, uses entirely different dashboard indicators. They measure safe water access, affordability, and lifeline provision for marginalized groups.
Lifeline provision?
Yeah, making sure nobody gets cut off. They track the reinvestment rates back into the infrastructure.
Which is huge.
And they measure ecological life ground indicators, like how well the watershed is protected from agricultural runoff, what the leakage rates are in the transport pipes, and strict limits on how much water can be extracted without damaging the ecosystem.
They're measuring the health of the entire organism, not just skimming the financial cream off the top.
Exactly.
But of course, Paris is not flawless. The paper is quick to point out the failure modes lurking in the shadows here.
Always.
Because public management always risks becoming overly centralized. It risks losing touch with the actual neighborhoods it serves. And there is always the danger that affordability gaps for the poorest citizens just get hidden beneath citywide averages.
Or the danger that the ecological needs of the watershed eventually get subordinated to the endless growing demand of a massive urban center.
Right, because cities always want more water.
Always. So the transferable grammar from Paris is not that public is always good. The lesson is that a water system only functions as a civil commons when public authority, universal access, rigorous ecological stewardship, and a real functional mechanism for public accountability are structurally welded together.
So think about the water flowing into your own home right now. For everyone listening, who manages it?
Good question.
When you turn on the tap, are you participating in a commons designed to keep your community viable, or are you triggering a microtransaction for a distant holding company?
It radically alters how you perceive the physical infrastructure around you.
It moves the mind from an extractive framework to a stewardship framework.
It really does.
So water secures the baseline viability of our cells. It keeps the biological machine running.
The foundation.
But human biology is incredibly fragile, and things inevitably break down. The plumbing gets complicated.
Oh, very complicated.
How do institutions handle the infinitely complex reality of human health? We are moving from the literal tap in the kitchen to the physical body, looking at how health is maintained before the catastrophic breakdown.
Right.
This takes us to the second case, Costa Rica's primary healthcare model, which is known as EBAIS.
Right. EBAIS stands for Equipos Básicos de Atención Integral de Salud, which translates to Basic Comprehensive Healthcare Teams.
Okay.
And Costa Rica established this model in the 1990s, and it represents a profound restructuring of the geography and timeline of healthcare.
The geography and timeline.
Yeah. The World Health Organization frequently highlights Costa Rica because they completely decentralized care. They organize it around community-based, multi-professional teams that provide public health, preventive care, and curative services directly within the neighborhoods where people actually live.
So the life good at stake here is what the paper terms embodied viability.
Right.
That is your capacity to simply remain healthy, to catch a physical breakdown before it becomes permanent, and to recover with dignity when you are injured.
And the money sequence pressure threatening that embodied viability is something almost everyone listening has likely experienced in heavily industrialized, market-driven health systems.
Yeah, sadly.
Health systems become deeply life-blind when the illness itself becomes the primary revenue source.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the incentive structure is completely inverted.
Completely.
Most modern healthcare is like waiting for your car engine to start smoking, violently shaking, and catching fire on the highway before you finally decide to pull over and change the oil.
And then the tow truck comes.
Right. And then you pay a massive, devastating towing and repair bill. The system makes all of its money off the catastrophe.
That analogy perfectly captures the absurdity of life-blind care. The system fragments the human body into isolated, billable episodes.
Billable episodes.
Yeah, because prevention is chronically underfunded. Telling someone how to avoid diabetes doesn't generate a lucrative short-term financial return.
Nobody makes money off a salad.
Exactly. The societal conditions that actually cause the disease, poor housing, toxic environments, lack of nutrition, they are ignored because they aren't medically billable. Disease is treated as an isolated individual malfunction to be repaired only after the crisis hits.
So Costa Rica's EBAIS system is essentially a mechanic walking out and checking the oil in your driveway every single morning.
That's a great way to put it.
The civil commons mechanism here relies on three massive pillars: proximity, prevention, and continuity.
Let's break those down. Proximity is the geographical pillar. Care is physically embedded in the daily life of the community.
It's right down the street.
Yeah. It is not locked away in a terrifying, distant, multi-billion dollar hospital complex that you only visit when you are absolutely terrified.
Right.
Then prevention is the operational pillar. Public health and early intervention are the core mission, not just a sideshow.
Okay.
And continuity is the temporal pillar. These multi-professional teams are assigned a specific population, and they monitor that population over time.
So they actually know you.
They know the grandparents. They know the kids. They do not wait for an episodic crisis to trigger an intervention.
But hold on. The reality of doing that sounds like an absolute logistical nightmare.
Oh, it's extremely difficult.
Because if you are constantly monitoring an entire population, sending teams into neighborhoods, tracking every single family, aren't you just burying healthcare workers under a mountain of paperwork?
Yeah.
Doesn't this create an unbearable bureaucratic burden that actually distracts from patient care?
You have hit on one of the most severe failure modes identified in the paper. The eBay ICE model is currently under immense institutional strain.
I would imagine so.
They are facing a rapidly aging demographic, a surge in chronic diseases, and severe workforce shortages. And the bureaucracy you mentioned is a very real threat.
Right.
The paper warns that administrative standardization, the obsession with logging every single interaction into a massive database, can become a trap. If the system starts privileging the completion of digital forms over the actual relational care of the patient, the civil commons degrades.
Right. If the metric for success becomes how many front doors did our team knock on today, instead of how healthy is the family behind the door, the system has completely lost the plot.
The metric replaces the reality.
Exactly.
But when the system holds its focus, the life capacity effects are undeniable. It secures bodily viability through early, proactive care.
Yeah.
It enables felt being because the paralyzing fear of medical bankruptcy is totally removed. And trust is established through consistent, familiar relationships with the care team.
You actually trust your doctor?
Exactly. It vastly reduces structural violence because healthcare is organized as a fundamental social right, a baseline condition of citizenship, rather than a luxury good tied to your purchasing power.
And the dashboard indicators reflect that philosophy. Like they aren't just looking at hospital admission rates.
Yeah.
They measure basic access, maternal care, preventable mortality, and the control of chronic conditions.
Right.
But they also measure subjective realities. Trust in the care providers, the absence of stigma, and the relational legitimacy of treating the patient as a rights-bearing human being rather than a unit of revenue.
The transferable grammar from Costa Rica is profound. Mm. Health becomes a true civil commons only when proximity, prevention, continuity, and universal access are organized far upstream, long before the disease is allowed to convert into a full-blown crisis.
Upstream care.
It is the organized, systemic enablement of life before the breakdown.
So Costa Rica proves we can design institutions that catch the physical body before it breaks.
Yes.
But humans aren't just biology. We aren't just a collection of functioning organs. We need to make sense of the world.
We need our minds.
Exactly. We need to imagine, communicate, and govern. And right now, most countries treat education exactly like that lifeline healthcare system we just talked about. A high-stakes, stressful, highly commodified assembly line.
Testing kids to death.
Right. But what happens if we treat the human mind as a civil commons? We move from the body to the mind with a comprehensive public education system in Finland.
Finland is arguably the most heavily scrutinized education system in the world.
Everyone studies them.
They really do. Their model is deeply rooted in universal public provision, an absolute, almost militant orientation toward equity, immense respect for teacher professionalism, and a focus on broad human formation rather than narrow, high-stakes credential competition.
Broad human formation.
Yeah. They provide free, high-quality education from early childhood straight through upper secondary levels.
So the life good at stake here is thought. But the paper defines thought so much more expansively than just memorizing dates for a history exam.
Well, absolutely.
Thought is imagination. It is discernment. It is language. The paper uses this beautiful phrase, the capacity to bring forth a shared world.
That is beautiful. And the threat to that capacity is what the paper calls human capital formation.
Human capital formation. Sounds so bleak.
It is. This is the money sequence pressure applied to the minds of children. It happens when an education system is reduced to a massive sorting mechanism for the labor market.
It's the assembly line. The only goal is private credential accumulation. You test the kids relentlessly, you rank them against each other, and you sort them into winners and losers based on standardized metrics.
Exactly.
It turns the profound, incredibly vulnerable act of learning into a brutal race for economic outputs. It turns students into products.
Exactly. And the civil commons mechanism Finland built to counter this is a publicly funded universal system deliberately oriented away from that fierce credential competition.
Well, how do they do it?
They remove the high-stakes standardized testing apparatus that dominates so many other nations. By removing the constant threat of ranking and failure, the system is designed to enable thought through genuine inquiry.
Wow.
It fosters felt being by prioritizing psychological safety, belonging, and actual joy in the learning process. It fosters relation through cooperation rather than zero-sum competition.
Okay, but we have to look at the cold, hard data here.
Right.
Let's look at it.
Because the source material does not paint Finland as some magical, flawless utopia where every child is a genius and nothing ever goes wrong.
Not at all.
The paper explicitly points out that according to recent OECD reports, Finland is actually facing declining PISA performance scores.
Yes.
They're experiencing growing pressures regarding equity, rising inequality within their borders, massive mental health strain among students, and the fracturing of attention caused by digital distraction.
The smartphones are everywhere.
Right. So if the absolute poster child for public education is currently struggling on the global dashboard, does this model actually survive contact with the modern world?
What's fascinating here is how Dr. Sali addresses that exact tension. The paper argues that civil commons are dynamic living ecosystems. They are not static ideals perfectly frozen in a museum. The purpose of analyzing Finland is not to declare it a permanent, unassailable success. The purpose is to observe what happens when a society fundamentally attempts to treat education as a civil commons of human capacity development rather than a competitive marketplace.
It's a continuous struggle, not a finish line.
Precisely. A life-coherent education commons must constantly interrogate itself. It cannot just rest on its historical reputation.
Right.
It must continually ask if it is still expanding thought, agency, and dignity for every single learner, especially as demographics shift and marginalized or migrant communities enter the system.
Because failure is always an option.
The failure modes are always circling. The temptation to revert to standardized metrics when scores drop, the fiscal strain of maintaining equity, the risk of narrowing the curriculum to boost international rankings.
I want to highlight something incredibly specific that the paper mentions almost in passing, but I think it is the key to the whole philosophy.
What's that?
The paper lists free school meals as a crucial civil commons supporting the education system.
Oh, yes.
Think about the profound logic of that. A life-blind system expects a child to learn calculus while their stomach is literally growling, treating the mind as totally separate from the body.
Which makes no sense.
Exactly. Finland's system recognizes that you cannot enable the mind if the biological baseline isn't met. Feeding the child is an educational imperative.
It treats the student as an integrated biological and intellectual being. And the dashboard indicators proposed by the paper for a life-coherent education system include literacy and critical thinking, yes.
Obviously.
But they also demand metrics on student well-being, on institutional trust, on the genuine autonomy granted to teachers, and on the specific inclusion rates of disabled and minority learners.
So the transferable lesson from Finland is not just, you know, ban standardized testing. It is that an education system only becomes a civil commons when its primary overriding mission is forming persons capable of judging, creating, caring, and actively participating in a democracy, rather than just churning out stressed out workers competing for a shrinking pool of credentials.
It is about equipping citizens with the tools to actually comprehend and actively shape the reality they share with others.
Which is a really heavy responsibility.
Okay.
But let's zoom out even further.
Okay.
We have secured the biological body with water and healthcare. We have nurtured the capacity for thought with education. But both that body and that mind require a physical environment to exist within.
They do.
They require a living planet. How do we protect the massive planetary life ground without turning nature into just another product on a shelf to be bought and sold?
It's the ultimate challenge.
It really is. And this brings us to the fourth case. Costa Rica's Payments for Ecosystem Services, or PES.
Right. So we return to Costa Rica for an entirely different kind of institutional architecture. According to the UN Forum on Forests, cited in the paper, Costa Rica has been a global pioneer in PES since 1997.
Oh.
The mechanism is relatively straightforward in theory. The government actively pays private landowners to conserve, protect, and restore forest coverage on their land.
They just pay them directly.
Yeah. And they specifically structure these payments around four distinct ecological services: carbon sequestration, the protection of water catchments, the conservation of biodiversity, and the preservation of scenic beauty.
And the funding mechanism for this is fascinating. They finance these payments primarily through taxes levied on fossil fuels and water usage.
Right.
So the lifeblood at stake here is the ecological life ground. It is the foundational layer of the house: the forests, the water cycles, the soil integrity, the climate regulation. As Dr. Saghielli points out, human life simply cannot flourish if we continuously disable the biospheric conditions that make our biology possible.
And the threat, of course, is that the global economic system is incredibly adept at reducing ecological systems to the money sequence.
Oh, absolutely.
Historically, a forest is only assigned financial value when it is cut down and sold as timber, or when it is entirely cleared to make way for profitable agriculture.
Okay, let's unpack this, because my alarms are ringing violently right now.
I thought they might be.
If the government of Costa Rica is literally cutting checks to landowners, paying them a specific monetary rate for carbon sequestration and scenic beauty, what are we actually doing here?
That sounds like a market.
Aren't we just putting a price tag on a nice view and a functioning water cycle?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this just the ultimate market capture, wearing a green, eco-friendly t-shirt? We are commodifying nature in order to save it.
That is the massive central philosophical tension of this case, and the paper does not shy away from it.
Yeah.
The risk of total commodification is severe. When you reduce an infinitely complex living, breathing ecosystem to a standardized bundle of marketable services, tradable credits, and carbon offsets, you are walking on the edge of a blade.
It's dangerous.
Very. This is exactly why Dr. Saley includes the PE case. It is an imperfect hybrid mechanism. It is not pure lifeblind market capture, but it is also not a pure uncompromised civil commons.
It's a compromise. It's using the master's tools to try and stop the master's house from burning to the ground.
That is exactly what it is. It is an attempt to use financial incentives to shield ecological functions from being completely obliterated by short-term market forces.
Okay.
The civil commons aspect here is the public institutional recognition that private forests generate shared universal life support functions. A forest isn't just a private asset, it is a public good.
Right. Everyone benefits from the oxygen.
Exactly. By taking money generated from fuel taxes, which represents a source of ecological harm, and redirecting it toward active conservation, the system attempts to force financial flows to serve life coherence.
And when it functions correctly, the life capacity effects are very real. It secures bodily viability by preventing massive flooding and maintaining air quality.
Yeah.
It enables felt being by providing a baseline of ecological security for the surrounding communities.
Mm.
It even enables economic action by generating sustainable livelihoods in rural stewardship and conservation, rather than forcing people to log the forest just to feed their families.
However, the failure modes are exceptionally dangerous. Beyond the philosophical degradation of reducing a living forest to a payment contract, there are deep structural equity concerns.
Like what?
Well, the paper highlights that these payments overwhelmingly favor landowners who possess formal, Western-style legal titles to their property.
Oh, which immediately creates a massive blind spot regarding indigenous communities.
Exactly. It structurally excludes indigenous populations and local communities who have deeply stewarded that exact land for generations, but who lack the specific, formalized property documentation required by the bureaucracy.
That is a profound form of structural violence disguised as environmentalism.
It truly is. Furthermore, the entire program is currently dependent on revenues from fossil fuel taxes.
Wait.
Yeah. As the necessary global transition away from fossil fuels accelerates, the funding mechanism for saving the forests will slowly starve.
That is quite the paradox. And there's that terrifying international failure mode, too. The offset market.
Yes.
The risk that a beautifully preserved patch of forest in Costa Rica is packaged into a financial instrument and sold to a massive corporation on the other side of the planet, allowing them to mathematically justify continuing to pollute their own local environment.
which completely subverts the goal of global ecological life ground protection.
A total greenwashing.
Yep. To monitor these complex risks, the dashboard indicators must be incredibly robust. They cannot just measure satellite imagery of forest cover or count the number of species.
Right.
They must measure cultural linguistic worlds.
Yeah.
They have to measure the health of indigenous stewardship and sacred land relations. They must track the distribution of the money, who is actually receiving the payments and who is bearing the burden of the restrictions.
The paper introduces a concept here called the value sequence indicator. It essentially asks one foundational question of the entire system. Does the finance ultimately serve the living forest, or does the living forest simply serve the financial instruments?
That is the razor's edge of the entire ecological challenge. Does the money serve the life ground, or does the life ground serve the money?
So the transferable lesson from Costa Rica's PS experiment is that an ecological commons only becomes life coherent when the financial mechanisms are fiercely subordinated to actual ecological regeneration, deep community equity, cultural recognition, and long-term repair.
Yes.
The moment the ecosystem is reduced to nothing more than a priced service on a spreadsheet, the commons is lost.
It is an incredibly delicate dance of valuing the ecology without surrendering it to the logic of the commodity.
Which leads us directly into a massive question of power.
Always comes back to power.
Well, always. Costa Rica shows us that public wealth can be redirected to protect life goods. But who actually gets to hold the pen? Who gets to decide how that public money is spent?
Crucial question.
We have talked about funding ecology, but now we need to talk about human agency, political power, and the governance of public wealth. Let's move to the fifth case. Porto Alegre's participatory budgeting.
So Porto Alegre, which is a major city in Brazil, represents one of the most vital governance experiments in modern history.
Okay.
In the late 1980s and throughout the 1990s, they pioneered a system called participatory budgeting. And according to the World Resources Institute study analyzed in the paper, this model was so profoundly effective that it eventually inspired over 2,700 similar government initiatives worldwide.
Wow, 2,700.
Yeah. Okay. It was an architecture where ordinary citizens, specifically focusing on those from low-income and historically marginalized neighborhoods, were given direct structural power to participate in defining municipal priorities and deciding exactly how a significant portion of the city's budget was allocated.
That's huge. The life good at stake here is agency. It is the fundamental human capacity to actually shape the decisions that dictate the conditions of your own life. Because, let's be honest, governance isn't life coherent just because it successfully paves the roads or administers services.
Right. An authoritarian dictatorship can pave roads efficiently.
Exactly. Governance only elevates into a civil commons when the human beings actually affected by the policies have real systemic power to participate in defining the priorities.
And the money sequence pressure threatening this agency is the traditional, opaque, closed-door nature of public budgeting.
The smoke-filled rooms.
Exactly. In standard systems, public budgets are almost entirely captured by political elites, deeply entrenched technical bureaucrats, massive debt obligations, and corporate agendas demanding endless infrastructure for growth.
Budgets are moral documents, but they're usually written by people who are totally insulated from the consequences of the math.
That's a great way to say it.
Without direct democratic participation, public budgets routinely reproduce structural violence. They will seamlessly allocate hundreds of millions of dollars toward a massive, gleaming new stadium or a highway that benefits wealthy developers, while systematically starving marginalized neighborhoods of basic life necessities like sanitation, clean water, and local health clinics.
And the civil commons mechanism developed in Porto Alegre was radical because it dragged the budget out of the back room.
Into the light, yeah.
It converted the allocation of public wealth from a closed, highly technical exercise into a massive citywide process of public learning and deliberation.
How did it practically work, though?
They physically set up community assemblies in the neighborhoods. Mm. Citizens gathered, they debated, they identified their most desperate local needs, they developed concrete, actionable proposals, and then they elected delegates who voted on the final allocation of the funds.
It treated public money not as an accounting puzzle for economists, but as a direct mechanism for life capacity allocation. And the effects were staggering. It mobilized massive amounts of civic energy. It enabled thought through deep, practical, civic learning people actually understanding how their city functioned.
Which is rare.
Very rare. It generated felt being rust by conferring deep dignity, societal recognition, and a sense of collective efficacy to people who had spent their entire lives being ignored by the state.
Yeah.
And on a purely practical level, it vastly improved civil commons access. It physically redirected the concrete and the pipes toward water, sanitation, schools, and housing in the most underserved areas.
But this case also provides our starkest lesson in institutional fragility.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The paper points out a tragic reality in the source data. Political support eventually waned, and the participatory budgeting program in Porto Alegre was officially suspended in 2017.
That is the heartbreaking part of this. If it was so empowering, if it fundamentally transformed the landscape of citizenship and delivered actual clean water to poor neighborhoods, why did it die?
It died because of the failure mode known as political reversal.
Political reversal.
Yeah. Participatory institutions do not exist in a vacuum. They exist within a brutal political ecosystem. The World Resources Institute study identified the non-negotiable conditions for success.
Which are?
You need impeccably structured participatory arrangements. You need adequate and reliable financial resources to actually fund the projects. And crucially, you need unwavering commitment from the executive government to actually implement the proposals the citizens generate.
Because if the citizens spend hundreds of hours deliberating and they finally vote for a local health clinic and the government just says, thanks for the suggestion, and builds a highway instead, the entire system instantly collapses into toxic cynicism.
Exactly. That collapses another specific failure mode called symbolic participation.
Just for show.
Yes. The citizens are consulted. They expend massive amounts of emotional and civic energy, but they hold no actual binding power. It is a performance of democracy, not the reality of it. In Porto Alegre, declining political support from changing mayoral administrations, coupled with severely reduced municipal funding, slowly starved the process. When participants realized their agonizing decisions were no longer being honored or funded by the state, they experienced deep burnout and fatigue. The assemblies emptied out.
So, massive reforms can be easily dismantled if they aren't protected by deep legal armor and continually renewed by the public.
Absolutely.
The dashboard indicators for governance can't just measure how many people showed up to a meeting. They have to measure decision influence, meaning what percentage of the community's proposals were actually fully funded and built.
Right.
They must track the distribution of the budget by neighborhood and class to ensure the money is actually flowing to the margins. And critically, they must measure repair. Is there a legally binding grievance process when the government inevitably fails to follow through on its promises?
The transferable lesson here is incredibly powerful, but deeply sobering. Governance only functions as a civil commons when affected communities hold real binding influence over resources and implementation.
But it's fragile.
Breathtakingly fragile. It requires deep legal institutionalization, independent funding streams, and an organized public commitment that can survive the changing hostile tides of electoral politics.
It is a constant, exhausting battle against institutional inertia.
Always.
All right, we have looked at the building blocks. We've secured water, health, the mind, the ecological life ground, and the agency of governance. But we have looked at all of them as separate, isolated mechanisms.
Right.
What if there was a single legal and institutional framework that attempted to integrate every single one of those elements simultaneously?
Which brings us to our final case.
That brings us to our final and, frankly, most mind-bending case study, the integrative masterclass of Te Awatupua.
This case takes us back to Aotearoa, New Zealand. In 2017, the government passed a piece of legislation known as the Te Awatupua, or Whanganui River Claims Settlement Act.
Okay.
This legislation legally recognized the Whanganui River as an indivisible and living whole, stretching all the way from the mountains to the sea.
The whole thing. Yes. It explicitly incorporated both the physical and the metaphysical elements of the river into the law. And most radically, the act declared the river to be a legal person.
A legal person. I really want everyone listening to pause and let that sink in. We are entirely accustomed to massive, faceless corporations possessing legal personhood, which is an abstract concept usually utilized to shield executives from liability.
Exactly.
But here, a living, flowing, physical river possesses all the rights, powers, duties, and liabilities of a legal person. The legal reality of this just breaks my brain.
It's hard to wrap your head around.
The river has liabilities. It can sue polluters, and technically, the river can be sued. But this is not just a clever environmental loophole drafted by some progressive lawyers in a boardroom.
No, not at all.
The act is the legal expression of a profound Maori principle. Ko te awa, ko te awa koa. I am the river and the river is me. So how does this completely upend the Western separation of humanity and nature?
If we connect this specific law to the overarching philosophy of the Life Coherent Peace Framework, this is the ultimate manifested expression of what Dr. Saley calls structural coupling.
Structural coupling.
Yeah. In traditional Western legal, economic, and philosophical frameworks, nature is strictly an external resource. It is a dead thing you extract financial value from, or it is an empty void where you dump your industrial waste.
Right. Humans exist inside the house. Nature is the raw material outside the house.
Yes, the ultimate fatal separation. But the Te Awa Tupua Act fundamentally obliterates that separation. It legally recognizes the inalienable enduring connection and the mutual responsibility of the Whanganui Iwi and Hapu to the health and well-being of the river.
They're tied together.
The biological and cultural viability of the indigenous people and the ecological viability of the river are mutually implicated. They cannot be separated in law or in life. This is not simply a rights of nature case study. It is a profound case of relational governance. It is a mechanism of deep historical redress for actions taken by the crown that systematically degraded the river's ecological, cultural, and spiritual value over generations.
So the life good at stake here is massive and integrated. It is the ecological, cultural life ground. It encompasses river health, indigenous identity, formal legal recognition, cultural continuity, and tangible historical repair.
Everything at once.
The civil commons mechanism here is a co-governance structure that forces the legal system to interact with the river from a perspective of living relation rather than dead resource extraction.
And because it is so integrated, the dashboard indicators here are uniquely comprehensive.
What do they measure?
They must measure ecological life ground factors like the chemical water quality and the biological integrity of the catchment. But they also measure cultural linguistic worlds.
Like what?
The vibrancy of the relationship between the iwi and the river, the use of the language, the honoring of the law, the execution of ceremony, and the fulfillment of ancestral responsibility.
That's incredible.
They measure the relational legitimacy and the actual operational effectiveness of these collaborative governance institutions. And crucially, they measure repair, tracking the actual historical redress and the specific restoration funds allocated by the state to heal past harms.
But even a massive paradigm-shifting legal victory like this has to have failure modes, right?
Absolutely. The paper is incredibly rigorous about not romanticizing even this profound achievement.
Because granting legal personhood on a piece of paper does not automatically or magically filter the toxins out of the water overnight.
No, it doesn't. The primary risk is that the personhood becomes entirely symbolic. If the human governance structures established to represent the river's voice are systematically underfunded or administratively weakened, or if they are continually subordinated to massive competing economic development pressures, the river will continue to suffer despite its new legal title.
Right. If a multinational energy consortium proposes a massive hydroelectric dam project that promises billions of dollars in revenue, does the river's legal personhood actually hold up in a high court under that kind of immense money sequence pressure?
Exactly.
That is the constant stress test of the law.
Additionally, the paper warns a highly specific international failure mode.
Oh, what is that?
There is a massive risk that well-intentioned environmental groups in other countries will look at this case, misread it as a simple, clever legal trick for conservation, and attempt to copy-paste the rights of nature legislation onto their own rivers while completely ignoring the specific indigenous treaty, historical, and deeply relational context that made it possible, legible, and legitimate in New Zealand.
Yeah, you cannot just slap legal personhood on a river in North America or Europe and expect it to function without the accompanying centuries of cultural and historical foundation.
It just becomes an empty show.
So the transferable lesson here is that ecological governance only becomes life coherent when the law itself is forced to recognize living, breathing relations, not merely resource interests. And crucially, that recognition must be paired with real binding governance authority, massive funded restoration, and an unflinching, legally mandated commitment to historical repair.
It represents an evolutionary shift from managing nature as an inventory of parts to relating to the ecosystem as a living ancestor and a shared living future.
Incredible. Okay, we have traversed the absolute peaks of what the civil commons can achieve across water, health, education, ecology, and deeply relational governance.
We've covered a lot.
But Dr. Saheeli's paper dedicates a very significant, very dark portion of its analysis to the failure modes. Because if we are going to attempt to build these life-saving systems, we have to know exactly how, why, and when they rot from the inside out.
Which they often do.
Why do so many well-intentioned, publicly funded systems end up feeling cold, coercive, deeply humiliating, or just completely useless to the people who need them most?
The central overriding danger that Paper 4 warns against is romanticization. Public institutions are not inherently virtuous simply because they are public.
They're definitely not.
They can, and frequently do, become life-blind in highly predictable structural ways. Dr. Sehi provides a rigorous diagnostic checklist of 8 specific capture and failure modes. We can group these to understand the underlying philosophy of institutional decay.
Let's weave through them, because understanding these traps is basically a survival guide for anyone trying to design a better system in their own community.
Yes, it is.
Let's start with the mechanisms of capture. The paper identifies bureaucratic, market, elite, and data capture. How do these actually manifest?
Bureaucratic capture is perhaps the most common. This occurs when a public system becomes entirely rigid, obsessively rule-bound, and deeply impersonal.
Like the DMV example.
Exactly. It redirects all of its energy toward preserving its own internal procedures, protecting its own managers, and justifying its own budget, while losing all contact with the actual human life capacity it was originally built to serve.
It becomes a machine that is humiliating to navigate.
It does. The safeguard against this is aggressive participatory oversight and forcing the institution to integrate dignity indicators into the performance reviews of its administrators.
Right, and market capture.
Market capture, which we discussed regarding Costa Rica's PES, is when a civil commons mechanism is slowly converted into a revenue model, an offset market, or a public-private partnership that ultimately subordinates the delivery of life goods to the generation of financial returns.
And elite capture is a classic trap in governance. Even in beautiful systems like Porto Alegre. Even in highly participatory setups, the actual benefits, the funding, and the contracts can easily flow toward groups that are already better resourced, more highly educated, or more politically connected.
Yes. The safeguard there involves relentlessly tracking distribution indicators, legally enforcing inclusion rules, and using equity weighting to actively prioritize marginalized voices over the loudest, wealthiest voices in the room.
Makes sense.
But data capture is perhaps the most insidious modern threat.
Data capture. This is when the metric completely replaces the living reality. Imagine a doctor who is forced to stare at an iPad to hit their data entry quotas for the day, completely ignoring the terrified patient sitting right in front of them.
It happens all the time.
The institution starts counting only what is easily measurable, like the number of forms processed or the test scores achieved, while entirely ignoring complex, messy human realities like felt being, cultural continuity, or impending ecological tipping points.
Exactly. When the map becomes more important than the territory, the institution is blind. The safeguard requires mandated narrative evidence, allowing the community to interpret the data and setting hard threshold indicators that trigger alarms when the system is causing systemic danger.
Then we have the failures of participation and continuity, political reversal and symbolic participation. We saw the tragedy of political reversal in Porto Alegre, where a life-serving institution simply collapses because it depended too heavily on a single political administration, a specific party platform, or one charismatic mayor.
Yeah, when the election flips, the commons is starved.
So what's the safeguard there?
The only safeguard against political reversal is deep, entrenched legal institutionalization and independent, locked-in funding streams that can survive the whiplash of election cycles.
Hard to do, but necessary.
And symbolic participation is the cruelest trick. This is consultation without actual decision-making power.
The illusion of choice.
Yes. Well, the community is invited to a town hall. They are asked for their passionate opinions. They pour their hearts out. But the elites have already signed the contracts in the back room. It turns civic participation into a cynical, exhausting performance.
A safeguard.
The safeguard is legally binding co-governance where the community holds a literal veto over the budget.
And finally, we have the failures of the physical reality. Ecological abstraction and repair failure. Ecological abstraction is when nature is technically recognized by a policy, but it is instantly reduced to compliance checkboxes, tradable carbon credits, or offset services without any real, messy, on-the-ground regeneration actually occurring. It's phantom environmentalism.
Which requires strict, independent ecological audits, the mandated integration of indigenous knowledge, and hard, immovable regeneration thresholds.
And repair failure.
Repair failure is the ultimate institutional sin. This occurs when an institution is forced by public pressure or a lawsuit to acknowledge the profound harm it has caused. It issues a beautifully written public apology, but it utterly fails to actually fund the restoration, provide financial compensation, redesign its internal systems, or hold a single executive accountable.
Thoughts and prayers, essentially.
Exactly. The apology is offered, but the machinery remains exactly the same. The safeguard is legally binding, fully funded, non-negotiable repair obligations with strict enforceable timelines.
Okay, looking at all of these incredibly detailed failure modes, I have to push back on one foundational philosophical aspect of the paper itself.
Sure, go ahead.
The entire framework we've discussed today uses a very specific, highly academic vocabulary: life value, life capacity, embodied viability, life coherence. Isn't there a massive, terrifying risk that this life value language simply becomes a new, shiny, technocratic vocabulary for the elites? Like, I can easily imagine a government using the language of life coherence to justify exerting massive, coercive, authoritarian power over local communities. We are restricting your movement or taking your land for the sake of your own long-term life capacity. It sounds like the perfect language for a benevolent dictatorship.
That is an incredibly astute observation, and it is a testament to the rigor of the paper that Dr. Sakili actually identifies this as the deepest, most profound danger of the entire framework.
Really?
Yes. Any language, even the beautiful language of human flourishing and ecological harmony, can be captured and weaponized by power. If the life-coherent framework is co-opted by a state bureaucracy that lacks fierce democratic accountability, it simply becomes a new, unassailable justification for control. The paper explicitly agrees with your warning.
So how do we prevent the cure from becoming the disease?
The paper notes that the ultimate safeguard against this ideological capture is not to abandon the necessary idea of the civil commons, but to intentionally, meticulously design institutions that possess the structural capacity to detect their own capture.
Detect their own capture.
Yes. A true life-coherent institution must be a learning system. It must be able to actively, accurately detect when its policies are disabling life, and it must have the legally mandated power and the dedicated funding to repair its own harms. It has to be constantly structurally accountable to the actual living beings it serves, not just to its own internal logic.
A self-correcting mechanism built into the foundation of the house. Which brings us to our final synthesis. We have covered an immense, overwhelming amount of ground today. We've looked at the remunicipalization of water in Paris, the proximity of health teams in Costa Rica, the removal of high-stakes testing in Finland, the complex ecological financing of Costa Rican forests, the fragile beauty of participatory budgeting in Brazil, and the mind-bending legal personhood of a living river in New Zealand.
Quite the journey.
It really is. So, expert, bring all of these disparate threads together for us. What is the ultimate point of Dr. Sakali presenting all of these radically different cases in one framework?
The point is definitively not mechanical replication. You cannot buy the blueprint of a house built for the desert and expect it to stand up in a swamp. What worked to remunicipalize water in the specific political climate of Paris cannot just be copy-pasted onto a struggling, underfunded city on another continent. Costa Rica's IBEAS system grew out of its highly specific national history and geography. It cannot be dropped perfectly intact into a completely different, highly privatized healthcare landscape. Porto Alegre's budgeting depended on a highly specific moment of profound political mobilization in Brazil.
You can't just transplant the organ and expect the body not to reject it.
Exactly. The transferable element here is not the specific institutional form. It is the underlying universal grammar.
Grammar.
Across all of these diverse, flawed, beautiful cases, a shared civil commons grammar emerges. First, a specific life good, whether it is water, health, thought, ecology, or agency, is explicitly named by the society as non-substitutable.
Okay.
Second, universal access or protection of that good is organized institutionally. Third, the movement of money and the demands of administration are strictly legally subordinated to the protection of life.
Money serves life, not the other way around.
Yes. Fourth, the people who are actually affected by the system possess structural power to participate in making meaning and making decisions. Fifth, the ecological and cultural life ground are fiercely protected, never treated as external dumping grounds.
And the final one.
And sixth, the institution is fundamentally capable of monitoring, repairing, and revising itself when it fails.
That grammar is what actually changes the world. And for you listening, I want to deeply emphasize that these institutions, these mechanisms we've spent the last hour dissecting, They are not utopian dreams pulled from a sci-fi novel.
They are very real.
They are not thought experiments. They already exist. They exist in fragments. They exist imperfectly. They exist under constant threat. But they are operating in communities all around the world right now.
Today.
They mathematically prove that it is entirely possible to organize human effort, human brilliance, and public wealth around something other than maximizing a short-term financial return.
They are historical approximations of an entirely different way of living. They show us that while civil commons can, and often do, fail, they can also succeed magnificently in securing the baseline means of life, mm-hmm. radically expanding human capacities, and drastically reducing structural violence.
Yep.
The empirical challenge for all of us is to build and defend institutions that serve life before money, administration, or power, and to have the relentless courage to correct them when they inevitably begin to drift.
And so we leave you with a final lingering thought to carry with you. I want you to look around your own community today. Think about the most vital, non-negotiable means of life you rely on, whether it's the water flowing for your kitchen tap, the health clinic down the street, the public school your kids attend, or the natural environment surrounding your town.
Just pick one.
Is it currently treated as a commodity to be bought and sold? Is it treated as a political football to be debated on television? Is it a revenue stream for a distant holding company? And what would it look like? What would actually change tomorrow if it were fundamentally redesigned using the grammar of a true civil commons? What if, from the deep foundation to the hidden wiring to the invisible plumbing, it was built to put life before money?
It is a profound question that requires us to completely rethink the very infrastructure of our daily lived reality.
The visible monuments of our society might be the gleaming skyscrapers and the massive bridges, but the true, enduring measure of our civilization is the invisible plumbing that keeps us all alive. Thanks for taking the deep dive with us.